Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, General Electric v. Hicks. Mr. Thiel.
Your Honors, opposing counsel, may it please the Court. My name is John Tile, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant. It is important at the beginning of this case to set up a timeline for the Court instead of going into a detailed fact pattern. If you draw out a timeline, on July 25, 2001, a receiver was appointed to operate and manage Midwest Transit. The issues in this case are forward-looking from that point on. They are not backward-looking into the corporation or into the derivative lawsuit prior to the receivership. The receivership appoints Marks as a zero on the dateline because he is responsible for what takes place only after he is appointed. He is not responsible for the acts of parties prior to his appointment. But it is this point in that timeline when the receiver's rights and duties begin. This appeal is about what the receiver did after he was appointed, with the focal point being what were his rights and duties.
Now, has your contract with GE Capital been reinstated? So you owe them?
Yes,
Your Honor.
How much
do you owe them?
That note has been paid off.
Pardon?
That note has been paid off.
The $2
million? It was my client cured the note after the lawsuit was filed and made a settlement agreement with GE Capital, and they dismissed the lawsuit against my client.
Did you pay the full $2 million back?
The settlement agreement was confidential, Your Honor, but there was a curing process to get the notes up to current. There was interest and penalties paid by my client, attorney's fees paid by my client pursuant to the breach that GE Capital sought through the promissory notes.
Okay, thanks.
The trial court in this case improperly applied 805 ILCS 5/8.60 because it is backward-looking from the date of the receivership's appointment, and it's improper in this case because we're looking forward into what the duties of the receiver are after he's appointed and how he manages the estate. Looking to Section 5/8.60, in pertinent part, it states if a transaction is fair to a corporation at the time it is authorized, approved, or ratified, the fact that the director of the corporation is directly or indirectly a party to the transaction is not grounds for invalidating the transaction or the director's vote regarding that transaction, provided, however, that in a proceeding contesting the validity of such a transaction, the person asserting the validity has the burden of proving fairness.
Well, what exactly are you asking for now?
Your Honor, we're asking the court to apply the laws.
No, concretely, what is it you want by way of relief?
We're asking the court to apply the receivership laws.
I'm asking you concretely, what do you want in the way of relief, not what you want in some...
Your Honor, we want a trial to be had on the leases because the receiver implicitly accepted those leases.
What are you asking for, please? Relief at the end of the litigation. What is it you hope to come out with?
Full value for the leases.
Money from the receiver? Is that what you're looking for?
That's correct. Money from the receiver.
Measured how?
Measured by the lease, the terms of the lease, Your Honor.
The inflated terms of the lease you want to enforce that you got with self-dealing?
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
I don't think so.
The terms of the lease, in fact, turning to the fairness of the lease, which...
Hicks leases his trailers to a company that he controls, right?
That's correct.
Well, that's a problem, right? He didn't have the consent of his co-director. That's called a self-dealing, right?
And, Your Honor, the proper lawsuit then is the receiver filing a suit against Mr. Hicks if he believes what he was paid in the past.
What difference does it make whether the receiver sues him or the receiver interposes a defense against Hicks's suit?
Because it's an improper defense, Your Honor.
Why? Why isn't that perfectly sensitive? I mean, you know, what... usually doesn't make it, if you have a right, it doesn't matter whether you assert it in a lawsuit or you assert it as a defense to someone else's lawsuit. Why should that make a difference?
Your Honor, then we're throwing 100 years worth of Illinois Supreme Court case law.
I don't believe it. What sense would that make to say you're going to have to sue, you can't interpose a defense if the other guy has beaten you to court? Would that make any sense?
Your Honor, it does. And there's two Illinois Supreme Court cases right on point.
Explain how it makes sense. Don't give me a case. Just explain to me how it makes sense.
It makes sense in this way. When the receiver is appointed and paid money to go in and analyze the affairs of a corporation, and he fails to do that, and he doesn't look at the contracts. In fact, he uses this equipment, $2 million worth of equipment, for free for 12 months. He has neglected his duty under the Illinois law, and in the cases that the Supreme Court has cited,
shouldn't he be able to interpose his defense that while he may have committed a wrong for which he should pay damages and so on, his damages should not be measured by a lease that was procured by self-dealing?
Well, there's no proof in this case that there was self-dealing, Your Honor. In fact, in both of the Supreme Court cases...
self-dealing. Maybe you're arguing that the lease charge isn't excessive, but certainly self-dealing. Right? I sell something to an entity that I control. That's self-dealing, right? If I set a very high price so that I make money on my trucks that I'm leasing, that's self-dealing.
Well, Your Honor, there was 10 years of history between the two shareholders and the other director whereby Mr. Hicks leased over 439 trailers to the company for the same lease price. The leases were approved by the other director, in addition to Mr. Hicks, and the only other shareholder at the time, Mr. Witters, signed the lease. So there's no self-dealing.
Mr. Tile, I gather from your perspective, if this case were to go back, the fairness of the contract would be really the triable issue. Am I correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, if that's correct, can you tell me what evidence the summary judgment record shows that you could rely on to establish the fairness of that lease?
Certainly, Your Honor. When the receiver was found in contempt by the district court for not turning the trailers over in a timely fashion, he had to go out and obtain third-party leases. We submitted those leases as evidence to the court what it would cost for replacement trailers of this kind.
And what was the result of that?
Those payments were well in excess of the flat rate contract that my client had given to the company.
How much a month were the leases? Third-party leases?
I believe the average, Your Honor, with when you lease from third parties, they charge mileage, damage, all sorts of other things that typically were dealt with within the company, and they were covered by the flat $450.
So that was $450 is what you got in the contempt proceeding. Am I correct?
That's correct.
I see, and you had. But that was that's really a short-term rate. Wasn't there a testimony in the summary judgment record again that the long-term lease rate was anywhere from $350 to $600?
That's by one of our affiants, Steve Nelson, yes.
Now, do you have any other evidence other than that to show that, in fact, you would be able to gain more than the quantum merit rate of $400 a trailer in a fairness proceeding?
Absolutely, Your Honor. My client has been in the trucking business and in the leasing business of trailers, whether it be by third party or through the company, through this $50 million corporation for 25 years, and his evidence in the case also supports $450 being fair rental value for a short three-year term lease for trailers that were brand new in June of 2000. These are brand new trailers. The loan payment itself was $67,000 a month, and he was only receiving $45,000 from the company. He was putting in an additional $22,000 a month.
That's the difference between the 450 that he was charging and the what, 727 he was paying at GE Capital?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why was he doing that?
Your Honor, because he felt he operated the company and he managed the company, and it served his best interest to make sure that they had these 53-foot trailers that the United States Postal Service was requiring at that time to prove that you had these in your stock to bid on these large million-plus-dollar mail routes. If you didn't have the million-dollar, or if you didn't have the 53-foot mail specification trailers, you couldn't even bid on the contracts.
Well, what I don't understand. If you're paying $727 and you're charging $450, what was the idea that he was going to charge more than $450? I don't understand. How is this going to become profitable?
Well, he's hoping to make money off the business, Your Honor.
I don't understand you. If you pay $450 for a trailer, I mean, if you charge $450 for a trailer that costs you $727, how do you make money?
Well, Your Honor, at the end of the lease, the trailers would have had some resale value, and in doing his doing business over the last 30 years, obviously, he would be aware that he could make it do. I'm running into my rebuttal time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thiel. Mr. Sharp.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Terry Sharp. I represent Midwest Transit and its receiver. These litigants have been before Your Honors before in case 03-1227. My client was appointed receiver, and that is a point in time. And at that point in time, the company was operating U.S. mail routes in 33 states, had almost 1,000 tractor trailers running across the United States, 700 employees, and 439 of the trailers that were being pulled belonged to Hal Hicks. 100 of those trailers are subject to this litigation. The court has determined previously quantum merit damages for the use of those trailers or rent for the use of those trailers. And we're here because Hal Hicks wants his insider profit. Incidentally, the amount that the court determined, an order was entered on it, is now being set off against the $22 million judgment that the receiver received in the circuit court below. Your Honor hit exactly on the point. It's the insider profits that Hal Hicks wants. He got his quantum merit. If you look at the affidavits that he filed, they have nothing to counter the fact that these leases are unfair. They have nothing to counter the fact that there is a daily rental there. If you read the affidavits in support of his motion, it's a bunch of bold assertions that are not tied into the stacks of documents that came in with that.
Well, Mr. Sharp, in the contempt proceeding, the district court gave them $450 a trailer. The quantum merit settlement, you ended up with a $400 figure. Why isn't the $450 figure a better reflection of the fair market price than the $400?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, the $400 was a compromise.
I understand.
The evidence that was before the district court in the contempt phase of this had to do with the daily spot rate of trailers. Obviously, you can rent a trailer for a long period of time, I'm going to get to that in a moment, for a much lower rate than you can on a daily basis. The evidence that was before the district court at the contempt phase was there was a matter of a few weeks or days or maybe even a month or more, and the spot rate was more appropriate.
I see.
In the evidence that was filed by Mr. Tile is a lease that was entered into with court approval between the receiver and the insiders on the other side of the transaction. It's Exhibit M that is before the court. And in there, when you work through all the mechanics of it, 75 trailers were leased for a three-year period for $250 a month. Now, albeit they were slightly older trailers, but there's also testimony in this record, and it's known fact throughout all the other litigation that's gone on, that a trailer as long as it doesn't leak and goes down the road and passes DOT inspection. So the insider on the other side were willing to lease trailers to this corporation for $250 a month. Your Honor asked the question, why would Hicks go into this financing arrangement with GE where he was paying for trailers over 3 years at a higher rate and only charging $450 a month? I think the reason he would do that is that the only way he could finance was over a shorter period of term. But the facts are in the record that would indicate these trailers last with reasonable maintenance for up to 20 years. So even though you pay for them in 3 years, you get a huge profit by continuing to lease the trailers. If you do a Westlaw search of Hal D. Hicks, you find out that he is certainly an icon of litigation. As this court noted in the case below, the court gave the receiver full control over the corporation and barred Hicks from interfering with the receiver. Hal Hicks is the Southern Illinois version of a robber baron of the 19th century. He is the equivalent of a Houston oil executive, and I would ask this court to write an opinion that sends a message that corporate insider dealings must comply with the Illinois law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Mr. Tile, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Very much, Your Honor.
Yes.
In response to the last comment, Your Honor, I would like this court to send a message.
All right, forget the messages. Come on. Get to the
Illinois law has been laid down for receiverships for 100 years. Supreme Court cases, 1896, two of them Spencer.
Get to the point.
The point is, Your Honor, opposing counsel likes to point the finger at the appellant, but there are duties that the receiver is responsible for, and in these two cases, they dealt with the same type of things, where a third party, another person, the receiver took advantage of a lease, and then at the end of the term, after he reaped all the benefits of it, he then didn't want to pay the person, so they ended up having to come in and sue, and the courts continuously held that you waive your right to argue invalidity because you had a duty and a right at the beginning of the term of the lease to say, hey, you're an insider, whatever the argument is.
Counsel, those cases are distinguishable because the validity of the leases in this case was in dispute from the moment of the receiver's appointment and was, in fact, a large part of the basis for the receiver's appointment. And the receiver was under direction from the state court in the receivership to not pay on the leases, but to pay directly to GE, not pay your client, but to pay directly to GE, as I understand the procedural history here.
Your Honor, one of the Supreme Court cases even talks about a court. Courts and or the receivers can't interfere with a person's right to their property. That doesn't give the receiver the right to hold Mr. Hicks's property. He could have taken those trailers and leased them somewhere else and made money.
They were titled in Midwest's name for at least some period of time before that mistake was unraveled.
Right. But that's not an issue in this court. And that we were granted summary judgment quickly down in the district court on that issue.
As I understand your argument, it is that the conflict of interest statute can only be offensively applied. It cannot be defensively asserted. Is there any support in the case law for the proposition that the statute cannot be asserted defensively?
Just in the plain language, I found no case law on the issue, but obviously there's plenty of case law on the other side. This is the receiver has this duty to accept or reject.
So there is no case support for that interpretation of the statute, that it cannot be invoked defensively?
Well, Your Honor, if you read the statute, there's nothing in it that indicates, it specifically states that it can only be used in a proceeding where somebody would have been challenging the validity. The receiver could have brought
a
suit.
The answer is apparently no. This is the first case to confront that issue?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to make one quick cite to the DeWolf case. The DeWolf case, which is a Supreme Court case, found that neither the court nor the receiver have any right to disregard contracts or violate obligations, and that a receiver cannot sequester property from the owner without the owner having redress. In both Spencer and DeWolf, Illinois Supreme Court found the receiver had implicitly accepted or adopted the leases and that they had waived their right to argue invalidity or unfairness. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel, and the court will take a very brief recess before the next argument.